CDC warns that tick season this year will be particularly bad.
What we've seen in Illinois over the last 30 years or so is about a tenfold increase in tick-borne illnesses that are reported to the state.
What do you need to know to protect yourself in Illinois? We get answers from health and medical professionals. But first, there are more bacteria cells in and on your body than there are human cells. And those bacteria play an important role in our health.
You see, a microbiome is like a whole rainforest in a drop of water. We are now discovering that our planet, our health, and perhaps even our happiness depend upon them.
That's Argonne National Labs' Jack Gilbert. How much are we messing with our natural ecosystems by overusing antibiotics? We'll speak with him and the Illinois Department of Public Health Director, Dr. Nirav Shah, about the importance of the dangers of misusing antibiotics and the overall importance of gut health. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. This is an encore edition of the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Think about this. There are 40 trillion bacteria cells living in and on you right now. That's more than the number of human cells you're made of. That's about 35 trillion. While bacteria often get a bad rap, the bacteria that we coexist with play important roles, helping digest our food, stimulating our immune system, even helping to protect us from illnesses. Knowing that, it should come as no surprise that protecting our gut health has important implications for our overall health, and that altering any bacteria in our body without reason can be problematic. One way we do that, by taking antibiotics. Of course, antibiotics can be life-saving, but if they're taken when they're not needed, that's bad news, not just for individuals, but also from a public health standpoint. That's what we're going to be talking about this hour on the 21st. If you have questions or comments for our guests, as always, our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show, 21ST Show. Joining us to talk about this is Dr. Nirav Shah. He's the director of the Illinois Department of Public Health. Dr. Shah, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Absolutely, Nyla. It's great to be with you.
Can you explain, first of all, just for us, how antibiotics work? Do they literally, when you're taking them, do they wipe out all the bacteria, the good and bad that you have?
You know, it depends on the kind of antibiotic that you're taking. There are, generally speaking, two types of antibiotics. The first are what are called wide-spectrum antibiotics, and as their name implies, they are like a big gun that just takes out every kind of bacteria in their line of sight. The other kind of antibiotics are the narrow-spectrum antibiotics, and those are ones that are engineered to just focus on particular bugs. Physicians are trained in which type to administer to which kind of patient, and it really depends on the clinical scenario. That's what governs what sort of antibiotic someone is given.
Yeah, and I know that we're going to be talking about ways that antibiotics are being misused. Do you feel like we're getting to a better understanding, both from a clinical perspective as well as patient education, about understanding when and what type of antibiotics should be used?
Well, since the problem of antibiotic resistance really came onto the scene a number of decades ago, there have been tremendous strides in educating physicians as well as patients on the proper use and stewardship of those antibiotics. There are some glimmers of hope on the horizon. The rates of inappropriate antibiotic prescribing in outpatient settings or even in hospitals have stabilized or gone down, but there is still a lot of work that remains. And that's why this issue is one of the top priorities here at the Illinois Department of Public Health.
That's Dr. Nirav Shah. He's the director of the Illinois Department of Public Health. You know, when you say that, I mentioned there's a study that we saw earlier this year that found that nearly one in three antibiotics prescribed in the U.S. today are unnecessary. So one in three sounds like a lot. How is this happening?
Well, in some cases, Nyla, even in the outpatient setting, for example, it could be up to half of the antibiotics that are prescribed are unnecessary.
Wow.
This occurs for an insidious set of reasons. Really, it comes down to a couple of things. The first is that prescribing antibiotics is easy. In some cases, it's difficult for a physician to know, for example, whether your cough is related to a virus, which doesn't need an antibiotic, or a bacteria, which might require one. But sometimes the diagnostic equipment, the tests that are needed to figure that out, are either unavailable or may take a couple days to get back in. So there's incentives on the physician side to sometimes prescribe the antibiotic, but there are also incentives on the patient side to demand antibiotics. For various anthropological or sociological reasons, a lot of folks feel like if they go to the doctor with a cough and they don't get a pill, they haven't gotten their money's worth. All of these things speak to the need for education, both on the provider side as well as on the patient side. One of the initiatives that we've been working on is a campaign to work with physicians to give them the tools they need to explain to patients why antibiotics are not always the right choice.
This is Dr. Nirav Shah. He's a director of the Illinois Department of Public Health. I want to bring someone else into this conversation as well. Jack Gilbert is the group leader for microbial ecology at Argonne National Labs. He also teaches at the University of Chicago. Jack, Professor Gilbert, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, nice to be here.
So I wonder if you can, we're talking about antibiotics and bacteria. I wonder if you can help us explain a little bit of your research. You work on the whole notion of a microbiome. Can you first even explain what a microbiome is?
Yeah, so a microbiome is a collection of bacteria, fungi, viruses, all intermingled and interacting together in an environment. We might consider that environment an ocean or a lake or a river or a plant or the human intestine. They're all just ecosystems to us. And so what we're really interested in understanding with antibiotics is to determine how those antibiotics disrupt that ecosystem, right? Exactly the same as if you cut down a forest to disrupt an ecosystem, an antibiotic has an impact upon the ecosystem of your gut. And we're only really just starting to understand the potential impacts that an antibiotic can have upon your overall system health.
Yeah, and what are those impacts? I mean, if you're talking about, as you said, cutting down a whole forest to further your analogy, what is the result of that?
Yeah, well, okay, so it depends upon the time of life that you have that antibiotic. So we know, we have a lot of evidence from working with children that antibiotics taken very early in life can have potentially have negative consequences for their development, both the neurological development, but also obesity and various allergy states such as food allergies or asthma. There are these conditions can actually be have a heightened risk of happening if you've had an antibiotic within the first year of life. And the number of antibiotic doses you get actually scales very well with the increase in risk for, say, developing obesity or developing an asthma attack. So we've started to see that the disruption of the microbiome early in life can have potential implications upon those diseases. That's not to say that you shouldn't take those antibiotics, but you should be very, very aware of the risks of taking them. And bear in mind, everybody that takes an antibiotic doesn't become obese and doesn't develop neurological problems and doesn't don't develop asthma or food allergies, but there's a heightened risk of developing those. And we're only just, as scientists, starting to understand how all of those things interact.
And Jack, when you say that, and when you say, especially when you're thinking about children, I'm sure parents that are listening are thinking, okay, so you've kind of laid out if a child has any antibiotic within its first year. But when you say how much antibiotics is too much, do we even know that yet for children?
We have no idea. And, you know, I'm a father. I have two sons, 9 and 7. And my 7-year-old just, had bronchitis, and I went to my doctor. He had a persistent cough, and it had been lasting for more than 4 weeks. So I went to my doctor, and I said to her, I'm a scientist. I almost preach the gospel according to control in antibiotics. So I need to be very, very sure if you are sure that my son needs an antibiotic to treat this bronchitis. And she says, look, it's extremely likely it's bacterial. Right, and he has all of these symptoms and signals of a bacterial bronchial infection, not a viral one. So, she said she would preach control of antibiotics to the nines, but she suggests very carefully in this time that it would be dangerous not to take the antibiotic. So, in my mind, we have to have those very frank conversations with our physicians and say, look, how sure are you that I need this antibiotic, or how sure are you that my child needs this antibiotic? And if they say to you, look, in my professional opinion, your child should take this antibiotic, it outweighs any potential risks, then you should definitely take that antibiotic.
Yeah. So, Dr. Shaw, as we're hearing Jack share the story of how he interacted with his family's pediatrician, do you feel like we need to be doing more education on the patient side as well? Our parents, especially when we're talking about children, do you think that parents are having sufficient enough conversations with their pediatricians about antibiotic use? What would you like to see happen?
Well, Professor Gilbert is right. We really need to encourage everyone to have that exact conversation with their healthcare provider. And the question, as he framed it, is exactly right. We are used to thinking about drugs in terms of side effects. And we all think about that. Do I really need to take this? What are the effects on my liver if I take this drug? Well, antibiotics are no different. Antibiotics have side effects. But one of the side effects that we are just now really starting to appreciate with the discussions around resistance is not the side effects to me personally, but the side effect to society.
Mm-hmm.
And getting folks, getting patients to really think about these external side effects of drugs like antibiotics, it's a challenge. But one of the ways that we can get to that is by starting to work with folks and patient groups to normalize the idea that an antibiotic is not the standard. To get folks comfortable with the fact that you might go to the doctor, the doctor might give you a thorough examination and ultimately conclude that what's causing your cough is actually just a virus. And then everyone being okay with you getting the medical advice that your grandmother probably gave, which is going home, getting a lot of fluids and getting a lot of rest, and then being okay in a couple days. Getting to that place of thinking that that was a great clinical encounter takes work. But that's one of the messages and one of the reasons that we're delighted to be on the air with you today.
Mm-hmm. Jack, even with all of your research and expertise, did you find, I'm just curious, was it hard for you to push back with your doctor to question that recommendation? I know I always say, I have this conversation, I think, with every, and Dr. Shaw, I had shared this with you at one point when we were talking about doing this segment. I had a whole conversation with a doctor a couple weeks ago where I just said, she prescribed antibiotics and I said, I don't want those. Do you think I really need to have them? Was it, Jack, did you feel like this is something where probably, I don't know if the pediatrician already knows what you do anyway, but was it hard for you to push back with your doctor?
I was nervous about doing it, absolutely. And that's, it seems funny coming from somebody who works in this field. But I don't want to appear to be overbearing to the pediatrician in question. So I didn't want to go in and say, look, I don't want to be militant about this. The antibiotics could disrupt my child's ecosystem and it could have negative consequences or could lead to increased antibiotic resistance. But I was very lucky in the fact that she was already quite well versed in this. And I'm sure many of the listeners on this show will have had experiences where their doctors are less educated as to the potential risks and are like, well, look, I don't care. I want to make sure that I give you this dose because the potential complications from not taking it severely outweigh any potential complications from taking it. This is a conversation that we need to be very careful about having. One of the great examples is otitis media, so having an ear infection. We regularly provide antibiotics for the treatment of ear infections in children, with very little evidence from double-blind trials, placebo-controlled trials, that the application of antibiotics significantly decreases the amount of time the children will suffer from that disease. So invariably, a child will get over otitis media very, very quickly. And there's a very, very, very small number of those children that will go on to suffer from a severe complication. And so we have to have a very frank discussion about risks and probabilities. And that is extremely difficult to have that conversation with the vast majority of the public. We've seen this problem with vaccines, for example. When you start talking about risks and probabilities, people will say, well, I don't want to be the risk factor.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Go on.
No, well, I was just going to say, well, when you say that, the risk factor, and we've seen this also with vaccines, and Dr. Shaw, you alluded to this, we've seen superbug problems. I wanted to ask you, Dr. Shaw, about, there was a study out last week from Rush University Medical Center in Chicago, finding that highly drug-resistant infections are rising among children. How extensive is this problem, particularly if we just want to focus on children right now and antibiotic-resistant bugs that we're seeing?
The problem is unfortunately very extensive, and it's one that's growing. The likelihood of a child coming down with a drug-resistant infection is growing with each passing year, and the problem there is that the magnitude of harm from having a resistant infection itself grows with each passing year. Nationwide, not just specific to children, but nationwide, in the United States, there are over 2 million infections each year that are associated with antibiotic-resistant bugs. That translates into about 23,000 deaths for both adults and children across the country. Unfortunately, as the resistance...
Is that every year, 23,000 deaths?
That is correct. Every year, approximately 23,000 deaths are associated with antibiotic-resistant bugs. And this is a problem that's going to grow every passing year. Now, not every condition, not every clinical condition has a problem with antibiotic resistance, but virtually all of them do. Some of the biggest concerns right now are with respect to things like garden variety pneumonia. Pneumonia 100 years ago was uniformly fatal, or very, very highly fatal. And if the resistance rates continue to keep creeping up, we could in the near future also find ourselves in an era where even routine clinical conditions like pneumonia, childbirth, or surgery could once again be life-threatening.
We're going to take a break. When we come back with, we're going to just take a break, Jack. I know you can weigh in when we come back. We'll continue this conversation with Jack Gilbert, Argonne National Labs, Jack Gilbert, and the Illinois Department of Public Health, Dr. Nirav Shah. You're listening to The 21st. Stay tuned.
The 21st is made possible by the library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, fostering discovery by providing information curation and archival services to extend scholarly impact from Urbana-Champaign to the state, the nation, and the world. The University Library at Illinois.
This is an encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about antibiotics and more specifically about the ways that antibiotics can be misused, what the implications are, not just for individual health, but for public health overall. My guests are the director of the Illinois Department of Public Health, Dr. Nirav Shah, and Professor Jack Gilbert, who teaches at the University of Chicago. He's also the group leader for microbial ecology at Argonne National Labs. Just before the break, we were talking about superbugs. And Dr. Shah, I just wanted to ask you about most recent news we've heard in terms of antibiotic resistance or superbugs, is we saw some news in Illinois with two incidents in September. There were two high school student athletes in Naperville who were treated for MRSA. And I wanted to ask you about how the Illinois Department of Public Health is tracking superbugs and how you're sort of dealing with that, even in how you're working to educate hospitals on dealing with this.
So I'll take both of those questions. In terms of tracking these, we work very closely not just with local hospitals, but also with a network of laboratories around the region, as well as with some of the laboratories at the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta. When specimens that are submitted to us, so when a hospital thinks that it might have a very highly resistant type of bug on its hands, it can send those specimens to us, and we work very closely with the CDC to really get the exact fingerprint of those bugs. The reason that's important is so that we can track the emergence and the travel of these bugs, not just around the region or around the country, but really around the globe. We live in an era, as everyone knows now, where an antibiotic-resistant bug can pop up in western China, but only be a few plane flights away from the city of Chicago. So getting the exact fingerprint, the DNA fingerprint of these bugs is really important. And that's one of the things that we at the department work with our colleagues at the national level to do. But as you noted, Nyla, educating hospitals and the clinicians who practice in hospitals is critical here. We have a campaign that we've started that works with hospitals as well as outpatient providers to educate them on the best stewardship principles. It's called Precious Drugs and Scary Bugs. And we work with physicians at all levels of practice to make sure that they have the most up-to-date information about antibiotic resistance so that they know what types of conditions are amenable to antibiotics and which ones, more importantly, are not. For example, the common cold or the common flu is not something that an antibiotic will help with. But the most important thing we do is help give them the communication tools that allow them to speak with patients and explain to them in a way that everyone will understand and appreciate why an antibiotic might not be the right choice for them.
Mm-hmm. And as we're thinking about this, and we're thinking not just about antibiotics, but other medications, Professor Gilbert, a couple years ago, President Obama launched the Precision Medicine Initiative, the central idea being that every person is unique. So doctors need to be thinking about treating each patient as a unique individual, whether that's looking at everyone's unique genetic composition, as well as you've said that in the field of precision medicine, they also need to have a greater focus on our microbiome and our bacteria. Why do you think that's an important interaction as well?
We all have a unique microbiome. So, you know, I can genetically identify individuals based on the genetic composition of their bacterium, not just their genome of their own DNA. So we know that each person has a unique microbiome, and that unique microbiome can influence how they respond to drugs, how they respond to therapies. We're able to sometimes stratify or identify patients that are going to respond really well to a treatment based on their microbial community in their stool, for example, or in their oral cavity. And so there is further increasing and very compelling evidence that monitoring their microbiome as well could be a very, very useful tool for identifying unique strategies or ways to treat those individuals.
And does that microbiome, that changes over time, though, because we're born without any bacteria, and that we start getting those immediately as soon as we're born, right? So is it a challenge to think about how that might be shifting over time? Does it change from childhood to adulthood in other places?
It does. It changes the composition of your microbiome actually stabilizes by between the ages of 1 and 2. And then you may have 5% of your microbiome being transient, i.e. bugs coming and going. But the vast majority of the species we find inside you are pretty consistent day to day. But their relative proportions changed very dramatically. So that's why it's quite important to be able to, if you will, sequence their microbiome before they are due in for a surgery in the hospital, or before we make a decision on a particular drug type, we could have their microbiome screened and sequenced and identified to be able to examine that. Now, currently, I want to make a very specific point. Currently, we do not have enough information to make any very specific observations or statements or prescribe any strategies based on the microbiome, but we are moving the research in that direction. And my hope is that in the next 5 to 10 years, we'll be in a much more secure place to make very predictive statements about what an individual person's microbiome might mean for their particular disease state or their particular treatment strategy.
Mm-hmm. I mean, as we're thinking about that and treatment strategies, Dr. Shaw, I wanted to ask you about what the status is of development of new antibiotics. Are we looking at antibiotics that will be able to kill sort of drug-resistant superbugs? Are we, as you mentioned, are we going back? I know in some cases, doctors are going back to the earliest antibiotics that we had because those original antibiotics haven't been used for some time. How are we doing on that front?
Well, while human behavior contributes to a lot of the resistance that we see, thankfully, another human endeavor, research and innovation, also provides a means for us to respond, such as you mentioned, through the development of new antibiotics. Unfortunately, the pace at which new antibiotics have been introduced has slowed quite considerably. Since 2012, there have only been 5 new antibiotics that have been approved by the FDA. Now, this slowdown isn't unique to antibiotics. It's been seen with other categories of drugs. But antibiotics are different from, say, blood pressure medications in a number of ways that affect the incentives. They often have a limited duration of treatment, a somewhat low price per dose, and, of course, as we're talking about here, the potential for the very rapid emergence of resistance that really results in some uncertain market longevity. So there
is that why research has slowed then, just because it's not a great business decision, it sounds like?
I don't know. I don't want to speculate exactly why the research. I don't know if the reason for the low introductions is higher regulatory requirements or just a shallower pipeline. I think there's a lot of things going on that are affecting the pharmaceutical industry writ large, and then some particular facets that are unique to antibiotics. But all of this points to the fact that there are policy levers that can actually be put into place to speed the development. In 2012, there was some legislation passed at the federal level called the Generating Antibiotic Initiatives Law that put into place some rules at FDA to really hasten the development and approval of antibiotics, and that seems to have started to make a difference. But these are the sorts of policy responses at a national level as well as at a state level that we can and should start thinking more about to really make sure our armamentarium doesn't get depleted.
Professor Gilbert, I wonder if we could talk about prevention. We've been talking so much about the back end of treatment in terms of once someone gets sick, but I wonder what we do know about the science. There's so much marketing and materials and products out there nowadays in the whole probiotics range. And there's a lot of claims that are out there for what probiotics can do. What do we know about the science of probiotics right now?
Well, okay, so probiotics are just bacterial organisms generally, which are proven to be suggested to have beneficial effects on health, right? So you consume enough of this bug, it will improve your health. I mean, this is a very old idea. Eli Metchnikoff, a Nobel Prize laureate from the beginning of the 20th century, suggested that consuming fermented milk was one way to maintain health. What's interesting in that statement is that while we have lots of evidence that some probiotics can be very beneficial in treating disease, especially gastrointestinal sickness, so diarrhea in children, or even other diseases, everything from joint pain to IBD, what we do not have any evidence of clinically is whether the microbiome in a probiotic can be useful in treating or maintaining health, so wellness. We lack an ability to define wellness appropriately in enough people to actually be able to determine whether continuous and regular consumption of probiotics as a yogurt or in a pill form actually has any benefit. And so I argue at the moment, if any of my colleagues or friends want to take a probiotic, they do so because they feel that it might make them better, with no actual evidence that it will help them to maintain wellness. But that doesn't mean they're not effective. It just means that we don't currently have evidence to support it, or we lack the definitions of what a healthy human being actually is.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like there's specific cases where you feel like, as you mentioned, irritable bowel syndrome, diarrhea, specific cases where you feel like probiotics can help people. Dr. Shaw, from a public health standpoint, I bet people ask you all the time about probiotics. What do you think about them?
My response could have been verbatim with what Jack mentioned.
Our
view is that health and wellness are the keys to a great life. And if there are folks out there that feel that probiotics are the key to their health and happiness, then great. But there is also sufficient evidence that suggests that one can lead a perfectly healthy life with never ingesting a probiotic.
Professor Gilbert, I wanted to ask you about a study. There was a study a couple of years ago that showed animals with an inflamed gut that were given probiotics became less anxious. And so kind of a really interesting connection between the gut and the brain. Is there anything new on that front?
Well, there is. The evidence is still building that disruptions in how the ecosystem of your gut functions, right? Remember, it's like a rainforest in there. So if we disrupt it, then that can have effects upon how the body works. Your microbes interact with your immune system. Your microbes interact with your hormones. But your microbes also interact through chemicals with how your nervous system works, how the neurons pass signals between each other. Remember, your gastrointestinal system has its own brain, you know, its own nervous system that's highly affected by how the bacteria are functioning, how the bacteria are consuming or generating different chemicals. So We now know that there is a lot of evidence to suggest that bacteria could be playing a role in depression and anxiety, but also in other neurodevelopmental conditions such as autism. And we're even starting to see evidence that things like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's could be affected by the microbiome. And whether it's causative or if you have Parkinson's, your microbiome changes is hard to understand at the moment. But what we do know is that when you change one thing in a system, it changes everything else. Okay, you know, the whole body is connected, and it's connected to the microbiome. So if the body changes, the microbiome changes. That could have feedback upon the body, making the body change even more. So we think the microbiome could play a role in exacerbating symptoms. Mm. I did want to bring up one point you mentioned earlier about antibiotics, and I'd be interested in Nirav's opinion on this. You know, we talk a lot about orally administered antibiotics. So you take these antibiotics as a pill and you pop it in your intestine and, you know, take those for 5 days and everything will be fine. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that having an injection of antibiotics, an intramuscular injection like I've had in the UK for treating an infection, can be more effective in treating the disease, as well as reducing the likelihood that you'll have a negative impact upon your gut microbes.
Hmm.
So I wonder if there's a discussion to be had about the difference between intramuscular injection of antibiotics versus orally administered antibiotics.
Yeah, Dr. Shah, does that, that's not maybe as, as Jack was saying, maybe that's something more common in the UK. Is that happening as much in American medicine?
Well, the clinical choice as to whether to administer an antibiotic intramuscularly through an injection or to administer it orally really depends on the patient's abilities and the degree of sickness. For a patient who's in extremis, not doing well, who probably can't tolerate swallowing, injected antibiotics or even intravenous antibiotics are indicated. Also, depending on where the infection is, an intravenous or an intramuscular antibiotic might be the way to go. So there are usually clinical factors. Now, there is some suggestion, as Jack noted in the literature, that when you give an antibiotic to someone orally, the first place it lands is in the gut, mm-hmm. and it starts working there. And it might, because of its first route there, decimate a lot of the gut bacteria, which might be responsible for some of the effects that we see, not just with resistance, but with some of the disruptions Jack mentioned. No better of a condition is this seen in than a clinical condition that's called C. diff, which stands for Clostridium difficile. This is an infection that occurs in the colon that is often associated from healthcare settings, and it really results from excessively administered antibiotics that really decimate the gut and all of the bacteria in it, and that then leads to an overgrowth of another bacterium that can cause significant problems.
Now, Dr. Shah, I know you guys have been working in Illinois hospitals to try to reduce the incidence of C. diff. What has IDPH been doing on that?
One of the best ways to reduce C. diff is to make sure that hospitals use antibiotics appropriately, or what's called antimicrobial stewardship. These are things that have actually shown tremendous improvements in the rates of C. diff, for example, in the United Kingdom, which reduced its rate 75% since 2007. So there are a couple of components to our strategy. The first is these strict controls over when and to what extent patients in the hospital get antibiotics that have to be approved by infectious disease specialists. The second aspect is strict infection control precautions to make sure that this bug, C. diff, doesn't invade susceptible people. And then the third is environmental cleaning that tries to eliminate the spores that are actually responsible for causing it. This three-pronged strategy in other settings, for example, in the UK, has been shown to reduce C. diff rates significantly. And we're already starting to see some benefits on the national level from implementing the strategy.
Interesting.
One interesting thing.
You know what? Unfortunately, Dr. Shah, we're out of time, but give me five. I could just finish your thought if you've got 10 seconds there.
One of the ways that the microbiome has been used clinically is in something called a fecal transplant, which is exactly what it sounds like, and it's actually used quite effectively in the treatment of C. diff.
We'll have to have both of you guys come back to talk about that, because we're ending on that note. Jack Gilbert, Dr. Nirav Shah, thank you both for joining us, talking about antibiotics, antibiotic resistance, and the microbiome. We're listening to 21st.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Listening to the 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. Tick season is here, and the CDC has some troubling news out earlier this month. It's going to be a bad season. May is one of the months that we should be paying attention to this issue. And not only are we on track to see record increases in the tick population, but there's also a new potentially fatal tick-borne illness that has been making its way across the Northeast and Great Lakes regions. The disease is called powassan. It's pretty rare. Only 75 cases have been reported in the U.S. over the past decade, but the CDC warns more cases are likely this year. In a few minutes, we'll learn more all about this with Dr. Jason Cole, Chairman of Emergency Services at Presence Covenant Medical Center in Urbana. But first, I'm joined by Marilyn O'Hara Ruiz. She's a Clinical Associate Professor of Pathobiology at the University of Illinois. She's also involved in a new CDC-funded regional center, the Upper Midwestern Center of Excellence in Vector-Borne Diseases. Marilyn, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Nyla.
We spent a lot of time talking about mosquitoes. In fact, you and I had a long conversation recently about mosquito-borne illnesses, about West Nile virus, about the Zika virus. Is this the time of year? Is May the time of year in particular we should be worried about ticks?
In fact, it is, yes. This is one of the times of year, this and in the fall, when a lot of the ticks are questing, and so they're looking for a host. And you'll see, in terms of when the illnesses actually occur, that you'll see a spike in illnesses. So Lyme disease, and then in the southern part of the state, we also have Rocky Mountain spotted fever.
And can you just remind us, Lyme disease, Rocky Mountain spotted fever, what those are and sort of what symptoms are and what people need to be careful about with that?
Sure. Now, these are both quite serious illnesses, and they are transmitted by ticks. So I know we've talked in the past about what is a vector. So the vector in this case is the tick, and the tick has a pathogen or a bacteria that causes infections in people. The Lyme disease is a disease that has a variety of severity. Like, it may not be extremely severe, but it can be make you quite ill. And so we have personal experience in my family with a person who did become ill with Lyme disease. And so we could see just how sick my son was, that he has, have a high fever and definitely need medical care.
Okay.
And the Rocky Mountain spotted fever is, in fact, actually more serious. And so that's one that if you are not treated within about 5 days, there is actually a mortality risk as well with the Rocky Mountain spotted fever.
And what are we looking at? I mean, we talk a lot about mosquito population and mosquito-borne illnesses on the rise. What about diseases spread by ticks?
So what we've seen in Illinois over the last 30 years or so is about a tenfold increase in tick-borne illnesses that are reported to the state. So this is an area where we're still at a lower level in some of these illnesses than some of the surrounding states. So north of us and east of us, there's more Lyme disease, but it's something certainly that is increasing in Illinois.
A lot of the work that you have done in the previous conversations we've had with you is about your work with data and mapping to help predict and hopefully prevent outbreaks of mosquito-borne illnesses. Is that something you could also do with ticks? Can you apply those models? Does that work?
We can't exactly apply the models because the ticks are actually quite different from mosquitoes. They actually have a 2-year life cycle, and they have different stages and that we have to account for. So with the mosquitoes, we have the larval stage, and then we have the adult stage, which are the two that we are most concerned about, and we can model those differently. With the ticks, we have the 4 different stages, and they also will take blood from different hosts. So a nymphal tick might take blood from a mouse, for example, but then a adult tick would be more likely to bite a dog or a deer.
And do we need to be primarily, from a public health standpoint, do we need to be primarily concerned about ticks? You know, we always sort of hear, like, walking in the woods when you're walking out in an area that's sort of more grassy to be careful. What sort of basic advice we should be thinking about?
So the advice that we give is to cover yourself, wear light clothing, tuck your pants into your socks. You can also use certain treatments on your clothing that can repel the ticks. And so if you spray your clothes with an anti-tick spray, that can also be effective.
And are mosquito repellents, are those also effective for ticks or not really?
Not 100%. So DEET is what we often recommend for mosquitoes, but it's not for ticks. It's not as effective for ticks. There's actually Perithrum is the name of a product, and so that is one that's especially good for spraying on your clothing, not on yourself.
And would you say then that we should be as vigilant about mosquito repellent as we should be about tick repellent?
That, and then, as I mentioned, tucking your pants into your socks and being very careful about checking for ticks when you return from a place that where you may have been exposed.
And so places you would be exposed, we've talked about outdoors. Where in particular should you be careful?
In the woods, certainly, but also places like Meadowbrook Park, if you're out walking around and you get off of the trail.
In the Champaign-Urbana area,
exactly,
sure.
So
basically any of our parks within central Illinois in particular or throughout the state?
Throughout the state, really. And another thing that we advise is to stay in the center of the path. Don't go off into the brush. So if you aren't immediately in contact with the low vegetation that you're seeing there next to your trail, then you'll be at much less risk. So stay in the center of the trail and try to avoid those areas.
And it sounds like don't go hiking in shorts. Sounds like another big thing, right?
And also if your dog is with you, that you should check your dog, because dogs also can have these same ticks and even some of the same illnesses that we have.
And it's not possible to have, I wonder what kind of tick repellents we should be thinking about for our animals.
They also have tick repellents for animals, certainly. And you can also...
And are those effective?
Yes, certainly. Uh-huh. So okay. That would be something that we'd recommend. You can also have Lyme vaccinations for dogs.
So, oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, good. So if you have a Lyme vaccination for your dog, I know flea and tick medicine for dogs is pretty standard. That just means they can't get sick, but it does mean they could transmit that to you, right? Or does it?
Well, they couldn't transmit it to you directly. And if the tick finishes getting its blood meal from your dog, they would just drop off and they wouldn't need another blood meal necessarily. So it's not as clear. This is where our modeling comes in. And
oh,
when you ask me, I think you started with that first question,
right?
Is can we apply what we know about mosquitoes to ticks? We can in some ways.
There are a lot of different variables, it sounds like.
Exactly. So it really is a different set of conditions that we need to consider.
So what's your hope with the research that you're doing at this new CDC-funded center regarding ticks? What are some questions you really would like to answer?
What we'd like to know is where the real true range of the different vector ticks is. It's been somewhat understudied. We haven't had as much information about that. The tick that carries Lyme disease has been steadily invading our area. It's been here since about the 1990s.
And by that, you mean all of Illinois?
Illinois, and especially along the rivers. We've seen it first, but we would like to have a better sense of the true geographic extent of that. And then in addition, with our modeling efforts, we'd like to know how does that relate to weather? Are there some years that are going to be worse than others? Are there some time periods when we would want people to be especially vigilant?
And then I feel like we have a pretty good basic understanding of weather conditions for mosquitoes. Is it something completely different for ticks?
It is different, yes. And it'll be different for the different species of ticks and for the different parts of the state.
How many different species of ticks do we have in Illinois?
So we have about 15, and about, three of those are known vectors.
Okay. Well, good advice for everybody as we're thinking about May is really the month to be thinking about this, right?
Now and then again in the fall is
okay.
Another time, and throughout the summer, really. But this time of year is a time when we should be especially careful.
Thanks again to Marilyn O'Hara Ruiz. She teaches pathobiology at the University of Illinois. She directs the Geographic Information Sciences and Spatial Analysis Lab. And we've been talking about this new CDC-funded regional center, the Upper Midwestern Center of Excellence in Vector-Borne Diseases. Marilyn, it's great to have you with us. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for having me.
As we continue this discussion, we're joined now by Dr. Jason Cole. He's chairman of emergency services at Presence Covenant Medical Center in Urbana. Dr. Cole, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Well, hello.
We just heard Marilyn talk about Lyme disease and Rocky Mountain spotted fever. Are those sort of the two main things people really need to be concerned about in terms of contracting diseases from ticks?
Well, with tick season on its way, the big distinguishing factor is the difference between the wood tick and the deer tick. The deer tick spreads Lyme disease, while the wood tick does not. The classic wound tick looks like a sesame seed, and it's spread from the American dog tick. The deer tick, on the other hand, is what what others call the back-legged tick, because you'll see in the pictorial a tick with large hind legs. In distinguishing the difference between the ticks, it becomes much easier to treat them.
So people, that's actually a good point that you're making. People might think ticks that dogs have could carry Lyme disease. What you're saying is that's not the right kind of tick. It's a different kind of tick.
Correct.
And so the kinds of ticks that do carry Lyme disease are those ones that are mostly then out in wooded areas in kind of forestry. That's kind of where they tend to habitat?
Correct. And they're endemic to the Wisconsin woodsy regions. They are in Illinois. They will be found in Illinois, but not with the same prevalence. The Rocky Mountain spotted fever is mostly in the Carolinas. However, there has been reported cases in the Midwest.
And so, Dr. Cole, what are some of the challenges associated with diagnosing tick-borne diseases in general? What should, from a medical standpoint, what's kind of hard for you all to determine whether it is Lyme disease or Rocky Mountain spotted fever?
So the classic Lyme disease rash is called erythema migrans. It's formed in the early stages after the tick bite, 1 to 30 days after the bite. And it's a central clearing rash with a large redness surrounding region. You can also see multiple rashes with this. The issue becomes if it's not detected early, the rash disappears, making the recognition of Lyme disease very difficult. And the sequelae of the disease or complications of the disease can be far, far worse if not caught early.
So when we talk about Lyme disease, what do people what do all of us need to know about whether or not we should be worried?
Identification of the rash is key. Immediate emergency care services or primary care specialists for evaluation of the rash is key to the diagnosis. If it's spotted early, stage therapy with doxycycline can be used. But preventative care with antibiotics is not recommended. And as I said previously, the reason why we want to catch this early is the actual rash is not a major problem. It's the complications of not detecting Lyme disease early, including the CNS manifestations, or otherwise known as central nervous system manifestations, including meningitis and inflammation of the heart, otherwise known as carditis.
And we just have about a minute left, Dr. Cole, but what about Rocky Mountain spotted fever? What should people be aware of in terms of symptoms with that?
So Rocky Mountain spotted fever is a rickettsia-borne rash, and it is also quite rare. There has been a few cases in Illinois, and the outcomes can be far more severe in terms of systemic illness and sepsis. These are not the types of same symptoms that you will find with Lyme's disease.
And from a reasonable standpoint then, from a common sense perspective, what do you think people should do if they discover a tick on their body?
Generally, the best laid plans is to immediately go and get immediate care at an emergency room or an urgent care center. Removal is done in the emergency rooms. Prophylactic treatment, like I said, is not recommended. It's basic treatment with antibiotics is guided by the stage and the clinical manifestations of the disease. The antibiotic of choice for Lyme's disease is doxycycline, otherwise known as tetracycline, for 14 to 21 days. In children less than 8 years of age, the only antibiotic that can be used is a penicillin derivative called amoxicillin.
All right. So good advice. If you see a tick, don't try to take it off. Go to a doctor. Thanks to Dr. Jason Cole. He's chairman of emergency services at Presence Covenant Medical Center in Urbana for giving us a few tips on that. Thanks for being with us, Dr. Cole.
Thank you so much.
That's all the time we have for today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for the 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa, we're easy to find, especially if you have NPR One enabled. Tell her, ask NPR One to play the 21st. all of those links, directions for Alexa, every other way to contact us. If you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, follow us on social media. We love hearing feedback from you. You can go to our website, 21stshow.org. If you follow us on Twitter, our handle is 21stshow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. On our Facebook page, if you search for the 21st to like us, you can also comment on what we're working on. You can post questions or comments you want us to ask on air. We're produced by Christine Herman, Ella Montecelio, and Sean Newman. Megan Jones is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Moore. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boudou. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Broadcasting today from the Medill Newsroom in downtown Chicago. Thanks for listening.